the little box and drew the curtains around her shuddering figure. So Leia traveled across the village like a queen. Behind her strode Daniel, carrying the sack that held all their belongings and leading the small goat by its tether. A neighbor boy carried the loom, the only valuable thing Leia possessed. There was so much work to do in the new house that he scarcely had time to think of the cave. Very early in the morning, before the women and girls were likely to be about, he carried the water jars to the well. This was not a man's job, nor was the sweeping or the cooking or the washing of clothes. Still, these things had to be done after a fashion. He had learned to take care of himself in the cave, where there had been no women to wait on them. But everything was more complicated here in the village, and in addition, there was Leia to provide for. The moment the shop door was open, villagers appeared with work they had saved for Simone's return. They watched the strange young blacksmith with suspicion, waiting to see what he could do. Daniel took up the challenge. He could not deny that it was a satisfaction to step every morning into Simone's tidy shop, stocked with bars of iron and hung with rows of tongs and chisels and hammers. For 5 years, Daniel had smelted his own ore and fashioned it with clumsy makeshift tools. He had never realized that he was learning to make up in skill what he lacked in equipment. After a little practice, he discovered that he could make Simone's tools do just what he wanted them to do. The work he turned out was true and light and strong. Word went round that the new smith was a good worker, for all his fierce, unapproachable scowl. With money in his pocket for the first time in his life, he was able to buy meat from the butcher and round flat loaves of barley bread from the baker. He did not eat as well as he had on the mountain, where meat from the farmer's flocks had been free for the plundering, but he suspected that Leia had never known such plenty. Once the shock of the journey and the terror of the new house wore away, Leia settled down unprotestingly. She began to take pleasure in very small things, in combing her long fair hair, in arranging the row of jars along the shelf, in watching the pattern of sunbeams along the plaster wall. She reminded him of Samson, the way she did not want to let him out of her sight. Odd, he thought, how he had shaken that great black shadow only to be chained now to a little gray one, scarcely bigger than a mouse, but inescapable. Leia insisted that the door between the house and shop be left open. For hours on end, she sat and watched him through the opening. When customers entered the shop, she would disappear, waiting concealed in a corner till they had gone. Sometimes, he suspected that she watched them too, from behind the long yellow hair. Daniel was concerned that she was idle all day long. He urged her to work at the loom, but though she was willing, she had no notion where to procure the thread. Her grandmother had brought her thread and taken away the finished cloth. That was all she knew. One morning, however, a man called at the shop, not with a tool to be mended, but with skeins of fine linen. He was the servant of a wealthy widow in Chorazin, who, it appeared, had bought all the cloth that Leia had woven. Daniel had assumed that charitable people had bought Leia's work out of pity. He was astonished to learn that this woman knew or cared nothing about his sister and desired the cloth for its fine quality. The servant was much relieved to have tracked down the weaver. Daniel set up the loom in the corner so that sitting before it, Leia could see through the open door into his shop. Then he watched with amazement as she threaded it with expert fingers. One morning, when business was slack, Daniel discovered a measure of wheat flour on Simone's shelf and decided to try his hand at bread making. He lighted a fire in the clay oven outside the door, measured out a little pile of the flour, stirred in some water, and began to pat the lumpy mixture into a flat cake, trying to remember how his mother had once done it. Absorbed in the work, he was startled when two small hands suddenly thrust themselves into the mixture. "That's not the way," Leia said softly. She patted the lump on a flat stone, rolled it deftly with a flat roller, which she took from the shelf, and handed him the thin circle of dough, ready to plaster against the wall of the oven. It gave off a delicious fragrance as it baked, and came from the oven crusty and satisfying. After that, they made their own bread together and saved the money that had gone to the baker. She taught him how to save a bit of dough for leavening for the next day's baking. An even greater surprise was to come. Behind the house, Simone had planted a small plot of vegetables, enough to supply his own solitary table. Through the luxuriant tangle of weeds which had sprouted untended, Daniel had glimpsed the shiny green of a cucumber, and one evening after he had closed his shop, he went out to clear away the weeds and see what else might be hiding there. He had worked for some time, liking the feel of the green plants and the smell of the earth, when he heard a soft footstep behind him, and suddenly Leia knelt beside him, thrusting her hands into the green leaves as she had thrust them into the dough.
"Don't, Daniel," she said. "You are pulling up all the carrots."
He watched her, almost afraid to speak.
"See?"
she showed him.
"These red leaves are beets, and these are onions. All the rest are weeds."
After that, Leia spent many of the daylight hours in the garden, hidden by the high surrounding wall. Her pale cheeks took on a faint, golden tinge. Blowing up his fire in the shop, Daniel pondered. Without the faintest idea what had really gone on in that dim-shuttered house behind the cheesemakers, he had taken for granted that Leia had lost her wits on the terrible night of her childhood. Was he any better, he thought now with shame, than the neighbors who would have tied her with ropes? Nor could he blame his grandmother. She had been grief-stricken and worked to the bone, terrified by the child's screaming spells, afraid to trust her with any household tasks. Now he saw that Leia remembered accurately almost everything she had watched her grandmother do. Praise be, she could take over most of the work of the house from now on, and he would feel more like a man. Yet as the days went by, he saw that he had been too quickly encouraged. The weaving progressed at snail's pace. The slightest effort exhausted the girl. She was often fretful, complaining of the horrid men who came into the shop and demanding that he lock the door against them. He could not get it through her head that he had a business to carry on. At a moment when she seemed most contented, a knock at the door, a shout in the distance, the most trivial sound could reduce her to utter helplessness, and it might be hours or even days before she would so much as pick up a spoon. On other days, she swept out the house, combed her hair, and sat passing the shuttle through the threads for hours. Daniel gave up trying to understand her and accepted her, as he had accepted Samson, as a burden he was doomed to carry. Late one afternoon, Daniel looked up to see a legionary standing in the doorway. He had almost forgotten Simone's warning, but even as his hammer arm stiffened, he remembered and laid down the hammer on the stone. He did not spit, but there were other ways of showing his contempt. He bent over his work, absorbed in it, sanding over and over an imaginary flaw on the surface of the smooth metal. Finally, in his own good time, he raised his head. He saw that he had made his point. The soldier's face had flushed an angry red, but he said nothing. Doubtless he too was under orders to preserve the peace. "My horse has a broken bridle ring," the soldier said, in stilted, reasonably good Aramaic. Daniel reached for the thing as though it were a scorpion. "It will take some time," he muttered. "Come for it tomorrow."
"I need it at once," the Roman answered. "I will wait for it now."
Daniel studied him, trying to assess how much delay the man would tolerate. Then, with a shrug, he set to work. The sooner the job was done, the sooner his shop would be rid of the man. The soldier did not sit down on the bench by the door as ordinary customers did. He hesitated, though pride, Daniel would not admit that it might be decency, waiting to be asked. Let him rot away on his feet, Daniel thought. He would get no such invitation in this shop. Turning his back, Daniel seized the bellows and blew up the fire. When he straightened again, The Roman was pulling off his helmet, revealing crisp, fair hair. He wiped the back of his hand across his wet forehead, where the metal had left an uncomfortable-looking crease. With a shock, Daniel saw that he was very young, certainly no older than Yoel. The beardless cheeks and chin scarcely needed a razor. His skin was white, mottled and peeling from exposure to the sun, so that he could not have seen service long under Galilean skies. The eyes that stared back at Daniel were a clear, bright blue. He looked as though he might be about to speak, and Daniel turned his back and resumed his work. He took a ridiculously long time for the simple job. When finally he turned again, the soldier still stood, looking hot and uncomfortable, swinging the bronze helmet from one hand. He was no longer looking at the anvil, and Daniel, swinging to follow that intense blue gaze, suddenly stiffened with horror. The door to Simone's house stood open. Leia, who had surely not known the man was there, was coming through the little rear door from the garden, her hands full of green lettuce. The long golden hair streamed around her shoulders, lighted up all around her head from the sunlight behind her. Her eyes, blue as the kitsa blossoms, were empty with surprise. Before she could shrink back, with one lunge, Daniel slammed the door between them. Murderous hate boiled up in him. How dare the man look at his sister? The very touch of his eyes had defiled her, as surely as though he had touched her with his hand. Daniel was quivering as he handed over the bridal ring. It took every ounce of his will not to hurl the coin back into that blonde face. That night, he began again to think of the mountain. 12. The Bronze Bow. Late one afternoon, a village boy came into the shop with a scythe to be mended. He had a bony, weather-toughened face under a shock of straight black hair, a defiant, touchy alertness, and a blackened eye that roused Daniel's curiosity. As Daniel examined the blade, the boy paced the length of the smithy floor. "Sit down," Daniel suggested, jerking an elbow toward the bench near the door. The boy, unable to sit for more than a moment, resumed his nervous pacing. Daniel set to work, blowing the waning fire with the bellows, heating and pounding straight the blade, then applying the sandstone to the nicks that the pebbly hand had left. From time to time, he glanced at the boy. Daniel seldom had words to spare for his customers. He did the work they required of him and took their money, not caring that he had a reputation for being surly. Today, for the first time, he was prompted to speak. For one thing, the boy was about his own age, and for another, he looked like a fighter. When he could make himself heard, Daniel attempted a joke. "Must have been quite a scrap you were in." There was no answering grin, but Daniel tried again. "What did you give him in return?" There was a pause. Then, "What could I?" the boy burst out. "There were 5 of them." Daniel's eyebrows lifted. He bent over his work. "My own friends!" Bitterness rasped through the boy's voice. "Waited and jumped on me coming home from the field last night." "Why?" "Because my father has gone to work for Shomer the tax collector." No wonder the boy looked defiant. It was a contemptible business for a Jew to hire himself out to collect the taxes the Romans did not stoop to collect for themselves. "There are better ways of earning a living," Daniel observed. "He's worn out trying. Last year it was the locusts, and this year some cockle seed got into the grain and the crop isn't worth harvesting. He could never meet the taxes." Daniel said nothing. "He could have sold my sister. There would have been no shame in that. But he's too soft-hearted."
"That's a hard choice," Daniel agreed.
"They force it on us, the cursed Romans. The land would feed us well enough if we were rid of them." Daniel leaned closer to the stone and carefully ground out a slight roughness. "But it's not true what they say," the boy went on. "My father would never put one penny of the taxes in his own pocket." Daniel did not answer. A tax collector might start out honest enough, he reflected, but a man weak enough to take the job at all would find it hard to resist the easy pickings. He felt embarrassed. It was a bad thing for a boy to have to be ashamed of his own father. "I guess this will do," he said, rubbing his thumb along the blade. He knew the boy did not want his sympathy. The boy paid him and moved toward the door, hesitating. Daniel guessed the shrinking with which he looked out into the twilight street. "Any chance they'll be waiting again?" he asked. The boy shrugged, but his eyes looked sick. "Hold on a minute," Daniel suggested. "When I close the shop, I've got to deliver an axe head. We can go along together."
"I can take care of myself,"
the boy flashed. "I don't doubt that. What's your name, by the way?"
"Nathan."
"Then come along with me, Nathan. There's something I'd like to tell you about." There was not much use talking, however, to one whose ears were straining for every sound on the dark roadway. Daniel could almost feel the tensed muscles of the boy beside him, but he observed with approval that the nervous stride did not falter. He gave up any attempt to talk and walked on in silence, savoring with keen pleasure the thought of the coming attack. He had not realized how much he had missed the rising prickle of anticipation. The rush came quickly out of the darkness. 6 or 7, Daniel noted, even while his fist sent the first comer sprawling. With a shout of sheer enjoyment, he caught 2 others, one with each hand. In the dark, there was a shriek.
"The blacksmith!"
A frantic wrench and the sound of tearing cloth, and one of his captives darted off in his tunic, leaving his cloak in Daniel's hand. The other, teeth rattling from a shake and a kick that would be remembered, stumbled after him. Then Daniel stood watching while his new friend dealt efficiently with 2 young attackers. "Not bad," he commented when the whole pack had slunk into the shadows. "You need to tighten your guard. Now, that's over, and you can pay attention to what I have to say. How would you like to use those fists of yours for a good purpose?" So Daniel won his first recruit in the village, Nathan, son of the new tax collector. As though Daniel's very eagerness had somehow acted as a signal between them, a few days later, Yoel walked into the smithy, bringing with him a recruit of his own. "How did you know where to find me?" Daniel demanded, eyeing with curiosity the slender scholarly boy who accompanied his friend.
"I ran into your friend Simone,"
Yoel told him, after just the slightest hesitation. "He told me you were looking out for his shop. He suggested I come to see you."
"A good thing," Daniel said. "I was wondering how I could get to Capernaum. There's business enough for 2 men here."
He tried to sound matter-of-fact, but he could not keep the pride out of his voice. Yoel showed a flattering interest in the shop. He wandered about, picking up the tools, weighing bars of metal from one hand to another. He was impressed with the shining gleam of a newly finished blade. "I've brought someone who wants to join with us," he said. "Kemuel feels as we do." Daniel looked uncomfortably at the newcomer. The boy was plainly wealthy and used to having his own way. There was an edge of disdain in his voice and in his proud, handsome face. Yet there was something else, too. The new boy whirled suddenly round at him.
"Do you mean to fight them?" he demanded. "Or are you playing a game? I came here to see if you are serious."
"We are serious," said Daniel levelly. "What right have you to ask?"
"Because I am tired of words," the boy answered. "Everywhere men talk and argue, while Israel lies helpless at the feet of Rome. Where is our courage? Why does no one dare to step forth? If you mean to fight them, then I am with you. But I have no use for children's games."
A feverish light burned in his dark eyes. He reminded Daniel of a panther, lean and dark and fiery, and his own fire leaped up to meet this boy's. He forgot his suspicion.
"You're welcome here, Kemuel," he said. "You'll find we're not playing a game."
Yes, Yoel had chosen well. Strong arms and muscles were easy to find. A fiery spirit was not so common. Presently, Nathan stopped by on his way home from the field, as he had formed a habit of doing. Already, Nathan had lost his resentful air. At first, awkward in the presence of the city boys, he soon surrendered to Yoel's friendliness. Daniel disconnected the bellows, banked the fire for the night, bolted the door, and the band of four held its first meeting. Certain of Simone's approval, Daniel offered the smithy as a gathering place. They agreed to meet on the third day of each week.
"If you want members," Nathan offered, "I could name you 10 here in our village who would give their right arms to join you."
Daniel hesitated.
"I've thought about that," he told them. "I know there are plenty. If word went out tomorrow, half the village would probably be with us before night. Some because they love Galilee or hate the Romans, and some just because they love a good fight.
But would they lose heart? The trouble is, we can't fight tomorrow. We've got to work slowly, and it may take a long time."
"How long?" Kemuel demanded.
"We must be strong enough so that we cannot fail." Daniel tried to remember how Roche had talked to them in the cave, whetting their impatience, but always holding it back, leashed for the day to come. He saw how much he still had to learn from Roche.
"Right now we need members who will be willing to work without any reward," he went on, not looking at Kemuel, but speaking chiefly to him. "We've got to be absolutely sure we can trust them, no matter what happens."
"Then we shouldn't take too many right away," Yoel said thoughtfully.
"We should not make it too easy," Kemuel spoke. "We only value the things we pay for."
"Who has money to pay?" Nathan bristled. "That would keep out all the villagers."
"I'm not speaking of money," Kemuel answered, with a touch of scorn. "I meant we must be committed altogether, without any reservation. Only that way can we be sure."
"We will each take the oath," Yoel reminded him. His friend was not satisfied.
"An oath can mean one thing to one and something altogether different to another," he argued.
Daniel suspected that he had argued habitually and enjoyed it, like the scribes who debated the fine points of the law.
"I know!"
Nathan sprang to his feet. He seized a rod of iron from the wall near him.
"We can brand ourselves! That way, we would know—"
"Are you forgetting the law?"
the scholar cut in icily.
"You shall not print any marks upon you."
It was exactly as though he had pulled his cloak tighter to avoid contamination.
"Peasant,"
his tone said unmistakably. Daniel's heart sank. Already his little army was behaving like the men in the cave.
"We don't need a brand."
Yoel spoke quickly, in the reasonable, friendly way that made everything he said so convincing. "If we choose carefully, we can trust each other. We will carry the sign of the bow in our minds. You know, from the Song of David. He trains my hands for war so that my arms can bend a bow of bronze. That is our password." Within 3 weeks, the four members had increased to 7, then to 9, 12, 16. Young men would meet each other on the village streets, in the school at Capernaum.
"Did you ever see a bow made of bronze?"
they might ask in passing. Or they would drop in at the smithy and pick up a lump of metal.
"It would make a good bow," they would say.
The password gave them pride and pleasure. They were bound together by the sign. On the first day of Ab, 21 boys crowded the smithy. Daniel looked around at them with a surge of elation.
"When can we tell Roche?"
Yoel demanded, eager for another glimpse of his hero.
"Not yet," Daniel answered.
He could not tell even Yoel how he dreamed of the moment when he would tell Roche. Now, while Yoel read aloud to the listening boys the thrilling accounts he had shared with Daniel in the passageway, of David and of Judas Maccabeus, Daniel thought how he would lead Roche down the mountain and confront him with an army, ready for his command. Then Roche would no longer be an outcast. Then everyone would recognize the leader they had longed for, and the day would be very near. On the morning after the third meeting, the fair-haired Roman soldier appeared again at the smithy. This time, he had a broken stirrup to be mended. He paid no attention to the sullen scowl that showed that his business was unwelcome. He stood, his feet planted well apart in that Roman pose they seemed to learn young, looking deliberately about the shop, at the shelves of metal bars, the tools hanging along the wall, the door that Daniel had instantly shut between them and the inner room. Daniel kept his eyes on his work, fighting down a compulsion to find out what the man might be looking at. Could there possibly be a sign of last night's meeting? He did not draw an easy breath till the Roman, taking his time about it, finally clanked through the door, mounted his horse, and rode off. Then, searching the room frantically, he could find nothing that could possibly have drawn the man's suspicion. Had it been his imagination that the man was looking for something? The Roman returned. Sometimes on the very day of a meeting, often on odd days between, he came now with work for his fellow legionaries, or with ridiculous excuses to have some perfectly sound bit of harness checked for a flaw. Once or twice, Daniel, hearing the hoofbeats in the street, looked up to see the man ride slowly by his door, and then, almost immediately, so soon the man could scarcely have turned his horse, ride slowly back again. He discovered the prints of a horse's hooves in the soft earth of the alleyway that ran along the garden wall, where there was no possible reason to ride a horse. No question now, the house was being watched. The meeting place would have to be changed. A new recruit, son of a farmer in the village, offered a solution. He led Daniel to an abandoned watchtower in his father's cucumber field, a small, round stone house in which the whole family had once lived during the time of harvest to watch lest thieves despoil the ripening crop. Below the tower, a shaft had been cut, designed, Daniel suspected, for hiding part of the crop from the count of the tax collector. It made a fine place to store the weapons they planned soon to have. The tower could be approached from many sides, across the field of vines. It was an ideal meeting place. Abruptly, almost as soon as they shifted the meeting place, the Romans stopped coming. Warily, they stationed a guard near the new headquarters, taking turns at the duty. Not a sign of the soldier was ever reported. Luck was with them, Daniel decided. Still, there was something about it that made him uneasy. 13. The Bronze Bow. Daniel's chief doubt about the new meeting place, that it would take him from home for long hours at a time, resolved itself more simply than he expected. Leia listened to his explanation and seemed to grow accustomed to his absences, as she had once accepted the fact that her grandmother must work in the fields. Leia was gaining confidence. She did not tire as readily at the loom. She had even completed a length of cloth which had been paid for by the servant of the widow of Chorazin. When Daniel had laid the shining silver talent in his sister's hand, she had been bewildered. He realized that she had never before known any recompense for her hours at the loom. He showed her how to sew the coin into her headscarf, where every village girl, even the poorest, boasted the jingling coins that would be her dowry. Leia was as enchanted as a child. Now she always wore the headdress as she worked, and from time to time, her hand stole up to touch the coin. Underneath the scarf, the long yellow hair was always combed and carefully arranged. Was it the work in the little garden that had brought a faint flush to her pale cheeks? One afternoon, looking through the door of his shop, Daniel saw two figures coming slowly along the road in the shimmering waves of heat. One, he soon saw, was Yoel. The other he was not sure of. A new recruit? The two figures were almost at his door before he recognized, with a shock of pleasure, that the one who had come with Yoel was his sister Malthace. She wore a yellow mantle with a green embroidered girdle and a green and white striped headdress that showed just the edge of the dark sweep of her hair. "I've never been in a blacksmith's shop before," she exclaimed, sweeping back the headdress and the impulsive gesture Daniel always remembered first when he thought of her.
"I've been begging you all to let me come to see it."
Embarrassed, Daniel wiped his sooty hands and brought a jar of water from the house, wishing he had more to offer.
"I'd like to ask you to come into Simone's house," he began.
"It doesn't matter. It's lovely here in the shop," said Malthace quickly.
The two visitors sat on the bench and watched him complete the lock that he had promised to deliver before sunset.
"I'm glad you came today," Daniel told Yoel when the work was done.
"There's an apprentice I want you to meet over in the Street of the Weavers. I think he wants to join us, but he has some foolish ideas in his head that the rabbi has taught him. I can't talk him out of them, but you could."
"Go along and see him," Malthace suggested. "I don't mind staying here alone. I'd rather start back when it's cooler."
"Are you sure?" "It would take only a short time."
It took a considerably longer time than Daniel had reckoned, because Yoel and the young weaver lost themselves in the intricacy of a theological debate. It was nearing sunset when they started back toward the smithy.
"He's going to be one of the best we have," Yoel said.
"But you should have stopped us. When I get started on an argument, I forget what time it is."
He did not seem to want to hurry, however, and shortly it appeared that he had something else on his mind.
"I've put off telling you this," he said finally. "I don't know just why. I saw your carpenter again."
"Was Simone with him?"
"Yes. As a matter of fact, when I told you that day that I'd run into Simone, that wasn't altogether true. I went back to Bethsaida on purpose. I went back several times. Lately, I've been getting up early to hear Jesus when he talks to the fishermen."
Daniel was surprised.
"You think he will help us?"
Yoel hesitated.
"He has helped me.
He has explained several points of the law that have always puzzled me."
"Explained them to you? You're the scholar. He is only a carpenter."
"I don't know where he got his training," Yoel said, "but he knows the scripture. Some of his ideas are the same as Father's, only he seems to go beyond somehow. He has a way of making something very clear and uncomplicated, so that you wonder why you never thought of it that way before."
"The first time I heard him," Daniel said,
"I thought that if only he and Roche could join together."
"I've thought so too.
So many people follow him. Some mornings there are more than 100. If anyone could persuade them. But then again, I'm not sure. I wish you'd come to listen to him, Daniel. Every time I hear him, I wish you were there. We both think."
"Does Kemuel go with you?"
Yoel laughed.
"Not Kemuel.
I persuaded him to go once. He was horrified. He's too much like Father.
No, Thasia goes with me. She..."
"Oh my word, I forgot Thasia. She'll be furious at me."
The girl was not in the smithy. As the two boys stood uncertainly in the doorway, a soft murmur of voices drifted through the inner door. Surely it could not be. Then Daniel heard the quick light peal of Thasia's laughter.
"Wait here," he told Yoel. There was no one in the inner room. Beyond, in the small garden, two girls sat side by side on the bench.
"Oh, Daniel,"
Leia cried, catching sight of her brother.
"Thasia came to see me."
Dumbfounded, Daniel stared from one to the other.
"How?"
he stammered, and then caught the warning of Thasia's eyes. "Don't spoil it," her look cautioned him quite plainly. He could think of nothing at all to say, could only stand stupidly. How had she managed it when no one, not a neighbor or an old friend, had been allowed to see Leia's face for almost 10 years?
"We've been having a lovely visit," Thasia said, as casually as though it happened every day.
"Leia has been showing me her vegetables. The time has gone fast. We had so much to talk about."
"These two, so utterly different. What could you talk about?"
he burst out before he could stop himself. Mischief danced in Thassia's eyes.
You,
she said. He felt his ears redden. He knew he would never know how she had accomplished it. Girls were strange creatures. He could not understand them. But he could see the change in his sister's face. She was fragile and pale beside Thassia's vivid beauty, but smiling with a smile so like their mother that it caught at his throat. Yoel, impatient and curious, came through the inner door. It was too much to hope that the miracle should include him, too. At the first glance of him, Leia's bright face grayed with fear. Thassia motioned him out of sight.
My brother and I must go home now, she said gently. But I will come back soon. You won't forget me, will you, Leia?
There was no answer. Leia's head was bent. The folds of the scarf that hid her face were trembling.
Here's something to remember me by, said Thassia.
She undid the green embroidered girdle from her waist and laid it gently across Leia's knees. The gold threads twinkled in the afternoon sun.
God be with you, she said quickly,
and not waiting for any answer, moved past Daniel through the smithy, too quickly for him to stop her or to try to thank her. Daniel stood looking down at his sister. He saw one finger slowly move out from the veil and touch the girdle, tracing the scarlet and blue and purple threads, as though they might vanish at too heavy a touch. It was the first beautiful thing she had ever owned. Thassia's visit caused Daniel to look at his sister with new eyes, and one thing that he had never noticed before suddenly shamed him. She spent all day weaving fine cloth for a wealthy woman, and she herself was dressed in a faded gray rag. Next morning, he took down the jar in which he kept the money his customers gave him, counted out a handful of coins, and made his way to the market. It was a confusing place, the kind a man did well to stay away from. The booths of the weavers were surrounded by women, chattering like a woods full of sparrows, fingering the lengths of scarlet and purple, bargaining with sharp, accusing screams. He gathered his courage and approached, trying to ignore their derisive glances. Presently, he found what he wanted, a length of smooth cotton, the clear, fresh blue of the Quetzal blossoms. How much? He growled. A girl with gold earrings studied him shrewdly.
Blue dye is rare, she said. 2 shekels.
He knew it was too much. He had no way of knowing how much too much, and he had no knack for bargaining anyway. He paid the money and cursed himself when she did not hide her contempt. Thread? He glared at her. When she had found it for him, do you have a needle too? He asked. The girl laughed.
We don't sell needles. Surely your wife must have a needle.
He said nothing, but the flush creeping up his cheeks made the girl laugh again.
Oh, she said. A present, is it?
Wait a minute. She delved beneath a pile of odd articles.
Here, take one of mine. I won't charge you for it.
The fine gesture, he could see, was an apology for the scandalous profit she had made on the cloth. He took the package and walked away, his ears red. Leia could not believe that the cloth was hers. Just to touch its smooth surface seemed to give her such joy that Daniel did not dare to suggest that it had a useful purpose. He waited for 2 mornings before he brought out the needle and thread. Leia watched his clumsy experiments, fascinated. Suddenly, a squeal of laughter broke from her, so startling that he dropped the needle. He had never heard her laugh before. The breathy little sound died away as he stared at her.
Oh, Daniel, you hold it like one of those great iron things. Give me that.
Can you thread a needle? He asked, astonished.
Anybody can thread a needle. Daniel, do you think...
Would you be angry with me if I made a dress out of the blue cloth? Through the door of the smithy, he watched Leia spread the cloth on the floor, marveling at the capable way she turned it this way and that as she cut.
Praise be!
Perhaps, She could even make him a new cloak.
14. The Bronze Bow. It started with an innocent question.
Daniel, what is a wedding?
Across the mat, with its earthen dishes, Daniel looked at his sister. They sat late over their morning meal. He knew that the shop door should be open, but he was in no hurry about it. Well into the morning hours, he had celebrated the wedding of his new friend, Nathan, son of the tax collector. He felt heavy-limbed and slow-witted. He wished Leia would stop prodding him with questions. How pitifully little the girl knew of the world outside their walls. Had their grandmother never talked to her? In the early days here in Simone's house, he and Leia had eaten their meals and done the work with few words. Then, out of his own loneliness, he had begun to talk. As he used to talk to Samson, sorting out his own thoughts aloud, not expecting any response. Leia had listened in silence, as Samson had done, but later she had astonished him by remembering. She had begun to ask questions, odd, childish questions, that revealed an incredible ignorance. Lately, since Thassia's visit, there had been altogether too many questions. She wanted to know about the girls he saw in the village, what they wore, what they did in the town, what they talked about. He did his best to answer her, because he could understand how his words were like a window through which she could peek out at a world of people she did not dare to meet face to face. Now, scowling in the effort, he tried to tell her about a wedding. "It's a feast," he said slowly. "On the day a man takes a bride into his house, when all his friends come to celebrate with him and wish him happiness."
"Does the bride have friends too?"
"Oh, yes, all making a fuss and talking all at once."
"Did many people come to Nathan's wedding?"
"Well, no, not so many as usual, I guess. Of course, this was the first wedding I've been to since that far-off night when he had carried a torch in his uncle's procession." He hurried on. "You see, Nathan is ashamed because his father's already making money from the tax collection, so he refused to let his father give the feast for him. I guess as weddings go, it was a pretty poor one, but Nathan was satisfied."
"Did you have good things to eat?"
"Yes, cakes and lots of fruit and grape wine."
Curse his selfishness. Couldn't he have brought her a morsel? "Tell me about it, Daniel."
Her blue eyes sparkled. He wished he had Yuel's gift for words. "First, we went to the bride's house. Her family had made garlands out of flowers. Nathan and Deborah stood in the garden behind the house, because the house was too small to fit in so many people."
"Was the bride pretty?"
"I don't know. I guess Nathan thought so."
"As pretty as Thassia?"
For a moment, he was disconcerted. Then he remembered that Thassia was the only girl she knew.
"No,"
he said honestly. "Not so pretty as you, either."
"What did she wear?"
Leia looked pleased and flushed.
"Oh,"
he floundered.
"A dress? White, I think it was. And a veil over her head. And the flowers. Then we all made a procession to Nathan's new house. There were some little boys who played on pipes, and we all carried torches, and the older people threw rice and grain at the bride."
"Why?"
"Oh, it's a custom, to wish her a fine family. And everyone sang songs and shouted and clapped their hands and stamped their feet."
He stopped at the alarm in her eyes. Even the mention of noise terrified her. She could not imagine that noise could be merry. He got to his feet and began to clear away the meal. But Leia did not move, only sat brooding over what he had told her. Finally, she asked,
"Will Nathan's bride live in his house with him all the time?"
"Of course, just as our mother and father lived in our house."
"Daniel,"
she said slowly,
"when you bring a bride here to live with you, what will happen to me?"
He was completely taken aback. "That's a silly question," he snapped. "I'm not going to marry. Why not?
Because I have no time for such foolishness. Not till the last Roman is gone from our land.
Is Nathan foolish because he has a bride?
Daniel felt his good humor sliding away.
It is another matter for Nathan. I have taken an oath. I live for just one thing. To rid us of our Roman masters.
His voice sounded loud in his own ears. Was he shouting at Leia? Or himself? Angrily, he began to pull on his cloak. He felt sore, as though she had unexpectedly probed a wound he had not even been aware of.
Are the Romans our masters?
She asked, her soft voice sounding puzzled.
Don't you even know that?
She sat silent. But as he opened the door of the shop, he saw that another question was beginning. He did not intend to listen. He had had enough for one morning, but the words caught him like a suddenly flashing net.
That soldier, the one who comes into your shop sometimes, the one who rides on the horse, is he a Roman?
Yes, may his bones rot.
Is he your master then?
Ask him. He would say he is.
Oh, Daniel, how silly. He is only a boy, not half so big and strong as you, and he is homesick.
A fury of impatience seized him.
What does it matter how strong he is? He carries a sword. He has the whole Roman army to protect him. Daniel, why are you so angry at the Romans?
In a rage of frustration, he glared at her.
Because they did this to you, he wanted to shout at her. Because they robbed you of your parents and a decent life and a chance to drink out of the marriage cup like that girl last night. Because they robbed you of everything. All but one thing, a brother to avenge you.
Suddenly, all he wanted was to get away from her. He felt choked, a heavy weight he could not understand dragged at him. But as he stumbled through the door, he turned back.
What made you say he was homesick?
Her eyes looked up at him, misty blue.
I think he is homesick, she said.
She bent and began to roll up the mat. Furious, he slammed the door behind him.
Homesick? That stiff-necked son of a camel!
But where had she learned the word? He could not put his mind on his work. His head throbbed. Without warning, Leia's childish questions had unleashed all the rebellion he had kept so carefully chained. All day at the forge, he thought of the mountain. Twice he laid down the hammer and went to stand in the doorway of Simone's shop, looking up at the line of hills shimmering in the heat against the unbroken blue of the sky. Up till now, he had been able to deal with his restlessness, push it down out of sight, hammer it out with great blows on the anvil. Today, it seized him with the strength of 100 demons. All day he stuck to his work, trying to hammer out his longing on the metal, trying to keep his eyes from the distant hills. In the late afternoon, he laid down the hammer, banged the fire carefully with earth as for the Sabbath, and bolted the door of the shop.
I must be away tonight, he told Leia. There's food and water and oil enough to burn all night.
You will come back?
Could she sense the demons that were driving him?
Of course I'll come back.
Bar the door when I have gone. He took the road toward the hills. With every step, the tiredness went out of him. As he began the long climb, he could feel the air growing cooler. A light breeze moved the tops of the cypress trees. With every breath, he drew in freedom. How many nights, lying on Simone's rooftop, had he imagined the moment when he would walk again into camp? For a few moments, it was just as he had pictured it, the shouts, the surprise, the good feeling that he had come home. But the brief excitement soon died down. Roche, after a sharp demand for news, went back to an oath-studded argument with two of the men. No one else had much to say to him. Daniel wandered about the camp, noticing a few new faces, trying hard to experience the elation he had expected to feel. Then he knew what was missing. He had been watching all the way up the trail, for a motion on the hillside above, for a familiar welcoming figure to come bounding down to meet him. Ridiculous. The black man had something better to do than to sit watching for him after all these weeks. But why wasn't Samson somewhere about? The forge had been heated. He could feel the warmth of the stone when he laid his hand against it.
"How's the village?"
asked Yoktan, coming in with a load of thorns which he flung down near the fire. There was a hint of hostility, or was it envy, in his voice.
"Did you bring anything to eat?"
Daniel looked surprised. He had come away empty-handed without a thought.
"We've had some trouble getting meat lately," Yoktan explained. "Some of the shepherds made an ambush. You'd think they'd taken lessons from us. Two of our men got beaten. Bad. The shepherds are in a mean humor, and Roche ordered us to lay low for a while."
Daniel was suddenly uncomfortable. Up here on the mountain, he had taken for granted that the flocks that grazed on the slopes were free for the taking. Now he knew by name the men who owned those flocks. They were not wealthy men.
"Oh well," Yoktan said. "Roche won't be patient long."
Daniel laughed, pushing away his uneasiness.
"Where's Samson?"
he inquired. Yoktan shrugged.
"That's anybody's guess. Samson has his own rules."
"Roche lets him?"
"Roche leaves well enough alone. If you ask me, he's sorry he ever got the brute. But Samson earns his keep. Look, there he is now. Goodness, look what he's brought."
The giant stood at the head of the path. Over his shoulder, as easily as a rabbit, was slung the carcass of a sheep that must have weighed more than a man. Swinging it from his shoulders, dropping it to the earth, he stood grinning, looking from man to man, waiting for their praise. With a shout, Daniel sprang forward. At the vast white-toothed smile that split the black face, his own spirits gave an answering leap. For a moment, the two stared at one another. Then Samson stepped over the carcass of the sheep. When he would have gone down on his knees, Daniel reached out both hands and grasped the powerful arms and held on hard. They stood grinning at each other wordlessly. Two men had pounced on the carcass and were worrying off the skin with the ferocity of jackals. Others heaped thorn branches on the fire and made ready the spit. Men poured from the cave into the clearing as word of a feast spread. Roche, glowering from the door of the cave, shrugged his shoulders and said nothing. While the meat was cooking, Daniel debated with himself. Was this the time to tell Roche about his band? But he did not want to spoil the moment when he could confront Roche with a real army. Besides, he had chosen a poor day to come back. Roche was obviously out of sorts.
"Your friend Yoel," Roche inquired once. "Ever see him again?"
"Yes," said Daniel. "Quite often."
"Keep an eye on him," Roche growled. "I'm going to need him soon."
He said no more, and only half listened as Daniel tried to tell him about the move to Simone's shop. Later in the night, Daniel sat watching the thorn fire leaping and crackling. He felt satisfied, full of roasted mutton. He leaned back against the rock, feeling with his shoulder blades for the remembered niches.
"It's good to be back," he said.
Good to be full,"
Yoktan commented, wiping a hand across his grease-smeared chin.
"We've got you to thank for it."
"You mean you've got Samson to thank?"
"Samson only did it for you. He knew you were coming, all right. He just knows things. He's deaf, maybe, but he hears things that aren't there. Look at him sitting there staring at you. You'd think you were one of his gods. You think it's an accident we've had the only good meal in a week?"
Someone else, too, knew that the meal had been no accident. Glancing at Roche, Daniel saw the small eyes, above the unkempt tangles of black beard, glittering at Samson. The dislike in them startled him.
Roche had gorged himself on the forbidden mutton, but he hadn't forgiven the one man in the camp who had dared to flout his orders. Later still, Daniel lay awake. Overhead, the stars were big and close. The cool air was clean, free of the mists and taint of the town. He lay filled with meat and wine, his old comrades stretched out beside him. It was all just as he had imagined it on those endless steaming nights in the town. Yet sleep did not come. He turned over, twisting his shoulders to fit a hump in the rocky ground. In these few weeks, his body had forgotten the feel of pebbles. In the same way, his mind shifted uncomfortably, trying to find a resting place. Pictures began to form in his memory. Leia alone behind a bolted door. Yoel reading aloud from the scroll. Thassia standing in the doorway of the smithy in her striped headdress. Simone looking away down the road, waiting for Daniel to accept the offer of all he owned. Simone had chosen a different leader. Daniel thought now of the one meal he had shared with Simone's comrades. He remembered the silence as Jesus had stood to bless the meager feast, and how each one had taken less than he needed so that those outside could be fed. A closeness had seemed to draw them all together. Tonight, who but Samson had cared that he had come back? All at once, he thought of Leia's little black goat. Would some child in the village be hungry because of tonight's feast? At the first gray glimmer, he got up. Instantly, Samson was awake. Daniel put a hand on his shoulder. For a moment, he stood, shaken by the question that stared from the dark eyes. Then he shook his head and made his way among the sleeping figures to the top of the trail. Samson did not try to follow him. He wished he could take the black man with him. But how could that huge figure fit into the narrow cage of his life at the smithy? Samson would alarm the villagers and terrify Leia into a corner forever. No, Samson belonged to the free life on the mountain. Where did he himself belong? The fire in Simone's forge had almost gone out. He raked back the ashes, blew on the coals, and coaxed it back to life. Then he opened the inner door to the house. Leia looked up at him, her blue eyes as lifeless as the fire. She had not combed her hair or bothered to get herself breakfast. With irritation, he saw that the water jar was empty and that he would have to stand in line at the well with the snickering women. He bent and picked up the jar, and the bars of his cage slid into place around him. 15. The Bronze Bow. From the morning when Daniel went back to hear Jesus on the shore